We're going to talk about the carpal tunnel syndrome chapter from the world's best free and peer-reviewed textbook, Orthopedia.
Orthopedia.
www.orthopedia.com, edited by Bernstein, Pinney, and Vayette.
That's right.
But before you take a test, and certainly before you take care of a patient, don't rely on us. Read the book.
Yeah, you got to read the book.
So today we're taking a deep dive into carpal tunnel syndrome.
Okay.
And we're going to extract the essential knowledge from this Orthopedia chapter to give you a clear understanding of what's involved.
Let's get right into it.
So,
Why don't we start with the anatomy?
Yeah.
When we talk about carpal tunnel syndrome, we're obviously talking about the carpal tunnel itself.
Right.
What is that structure?
That's a good place to start.
Yeah.
So in simple terms, what is the carpal tunnel?
So the carpal tunnel is a narrow passageway located in your wrist.
Okay.
Imagine a tunnel, right?
Okay.
And within this confined space reside the median nerve, that's the key player in carpal tunnel syndrome, and 9 flexor tendons. These tendons are what allow your fingers to bend.
Okay.
The tunnel structure is crucial because it keeps these tendons snug against the wrist bones, preventing them from bowstringing outwards when you flex your fingers.
Okay, so it's a structural necessity for hand function.
It is.
So then what forms this tunnel? What are the boundaries?
Think of the carpal bones, those small bones in your wrist, mm-hmm. as creating the floor and the sides of this tunnel.
Okay.
And the roof, the top of the tunnel, is formed by a strong band of ligamentous tissue called the transverse carpal ligament.
Uh-huh.
And it essentially completes the enclosure.
Okay, so we've got the physical space now. Let's focus on the median nerve.
Right.
What is its role specifically in the context of carpal tunnel syndrome?
Yeah, so the median nerve has functions extending further up the arm.
Yeah.
But for carpal tunnel syndrome, we're primarily interested in its role in the hand.
Got it.
And it has two main types of functions, sensory and motor.
Okay, so let's start with sensation.
Okay.
What areas of the hand does the median nerve provide feeling to?
Yeah, so sensorially, the median nerve is responsible for the skin on the palmar side. Mm. That's your palm of your thumb, index finger, middle finger, and the side of your ring finger closest to your thumb.
Okay.
It also provides sensation to the skin over the radial part of your palm itself.
Got it. And what about its motor function in the hand?
Yeah.
What muscles does it control?
So motor-wise, the median nerve supplies 3 of the muscles located at the base of your thumb.
Okay.
These are really important for opposition, that movement that allows you to touch your thumb to your other fingers and for grasping.
Mm-hmm.
It also innervates the lumbrical muscles that go to the index and middle fingers, contributing to fine, precise movements of those digits.
Okay.
The Orthopedia chapter provides the specific names of these muscles if you want to get into that level of detail.
Yeah, for the purposes of our conversation, we don't need to get too deep into that.
Yeah.
But so we have this anatomy of the tunnel and the crucial role of the median nerve within it.
Right.
Now let's get to the core of the issue. Carpal tunnel syndrome is technically defined as a compression neuropathy of the median nerve as it passes through the carpal tunnel at the wrist.
Uh-huh.
So that's a bit of medical jargon.
Yeah.
Can you break that down for us in simpler terms?
Absolutely. So let's unpack that definition piece by piece.
Okay.
First, neuropathy simply means that a nerve isn't working correctly.
Okay.
In this case, it's the median nerve that's experiencing dysfunction.
Okay.
The compression part tells us why the nerve isn't working well.
Right.
So when the median nerve is squeezed or compressed within the tight confines of the carpal tunnel, it can lead to a reduction in blood flow to the nerve.
Okay.
And just like any other tissue in the body, if a nerve doesn't receive an adequate blood supply, a condition we call ischemia, its function becomes impaired.
Got it.
Finally, the definition specifies where this is happening.
Yeah.
Within the carpal tunnel at the wrist. Because of this localized compression, it's the function of the median nerve distal to the tunnel, meaning further down in the hand, that ends up being affected.
That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
So with this understanding of what's going on at a physiological level, what does carpal tunnel syndrome actually look like when someone experiences it?
Right.
What are the typical symptoms that bring a patient to the doctor?
So patients commonly report a combination of pain numbness and that familiar pins and needles sensation, what we call paresthesias, in the areas of the hand supplied by the median nerve, typically the thumb, index finger, and long finger.
Okay.
This distribution of symptoms is quite characteristic of carpal tunnel syndrome.
And are there any other symptoms that might develop, particularly if that compression persists over time?
Yes. With prolonged compression, patients can start to notice weakness in the hand, especially in those thumb muscles that are so important for grip strength and fine motor control. This can then translate into difficulties with tasks that require dexterity and precise movements like buttoning a shirt or picking up small objects.
So we understand the symptoms now. What are the underlying causes of carpal tunnel syndrome?
Right.
What factors can lead to this increased pressure on the median nerve within the carpal tunnel?
So interestingly, in a significant number of cases, we can't actually identify a specific cause.
Really?
These are classified as idiopathic.
Oh, wow.
Meaning they arise spontaneously without a clear identifiable trigger.
Interesting.
Yeah.
That's
medicine for you sometimes.
Yeah.
The fact that most cases are idiopathic really underscores how complex and multifactorial musculoskeletal conditions can be.
Right.
You know, we can identify the mechanism of nerve compression, but the precise trigger often remains elusive, suggesting a combination of subtle individual predispositions and environmental factors.
So are there any known anatomical factors
that
can predispose someone to carpal tunnel syndrome?
Yeah. Although they are less common, certain anatomical variations or issues can play a role.
Okay.
For example, ganglion cysts.
Uh-huh.
Those non-cancerous fluid-filled sacs that can sometimes develop near joints and tendons in the wrist can occasionally grow in a location that puts direct pressure on the median nerve within the carpal tunnel.
Okay, what about other underlying medical conditions? Can they contribute to carpal tunnel syndrome?
Absolutely. Certain systemic conditions can be associated with an increased risk of developing carpal tunnel syndrome.
Such as?
Rheumatoid arthritis, for instance.
Okay.
Is an inflammatory condition that can cause a thickening of the synovium. That's the lining of the joints and tendons in the wrist.
Uh-huh.
This local synovial proliferation can then lead to chronic compression of the median nerve.
Okay.
Yeah.
And I understand that pregnancy can also be a factor for some individuals.
That's correct. Carpal tunnel syndrome is known to occur during pregnancy, often in the third trimester.
Okay.
The prevailing theory here is that it might be related to fluid retention, which can increase the pressure within the relatively confined space of the carpal tunnel.
Speaking of potential causes.
Right.
This is a topic a lot of people are curious about.
Yeah.
You didn't mention typing or using a computer mouse.
Mm-hmm.
Is it true or just a widespread myth that office work involving repetitive hand movements?
Right.
Like typing or using a mouse can actually cause carpal tunnel syndrome?
That's a really important question.
Yeah.
And it addresses a very common belief.
Right.
The current body of evidence suggests that carpal tunnel syndrome has not been definitively shown to be directly caused by routine office work activities.
Okay.
Like typing or using a computer mouse.
So that might be surprising information for a lot of people.
It might.
So what's the basis for this understanding?
Well, the National Institutes of Health.
Okay, the NIH.
The NIH has actually stated that there is little clinical data to prove whether repetitive and forceful movements of the hand and wrist during work or leisure activities can cause carpal tunnel syndrome. What's considered more likely is that these types of activities might exacerbate the symptoms in someone who already has a pre-existing susceptibility to carpal tunnel syndrome.
Okay. So while typing might not cause it, the Orthopedia chapter doesn't really elaborate on whether certain ergonomic practices are still recommended for those with pre-existing conditions or to potentially mitigate symptom exacerbation.
Right.
That distinction is important. And you used an analogy in the notes that I think could be helpful here.
Yeah.
Can you share that?
Certainly. So think about someone who has coronary artery disease.
Okay.
They might experience chest pain or angina when they climb a flight of stairs.
Yeah.
But the stair climbing itself didn't cause the underlying heart disease.
Right.
Similarly, while someone with carpal tunnel syndrome might experience numbness and tingling while typing, the typing itself is likely not the primary cause of the condition.
Right.
It may simply be an activity that brings out or highlights the underlying nerve compression.
Right. So it's not like it's a good idea to go out and you know, bang on a keyboard all day.
Exactly. Yeah.
Just because you think that's not going to cause it.
Right. It's not a preventative measure.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. So now when a doctor examines a patient, they suspect might have carpal tunnel syndrome.
Right.
What are the objective physical findings they might look for?
So interestingly, the objective physical findings in carpal tunnel syndrome can be quite subtle.
Okay.
Especially in the earlier stages of the condition.
Mm.
The only truly objective finding that might be observed is atrophy or wasting of the thenar muscles.
Okay.
Those muscles at the base of the thumb.
Right.
But this is typically only evident in more chronic and severe cases where the nerve compression has been significant and prolonged.
Okay. So if objective signs are often minimal, how is the diagnosis of carpal tunnel syndrome usually made?
The diagnosis of carpal tunnel syndrome primarily relies on the patient's subjective symptoms, what they tell the doctor about what they are experiencing. This includes those sensory disturbances, like numbness and tingling in the characteristic distribution,
yeah.
But also their reported loss of hand dexterity and a feeling of fatigability in the hand.
Uh-huh.
These subjective reports often correlate with the underlying issue of decreased motor nerve conduction and the potential for muscle atrophy, even if it's not yet visibly apparent on examination.
Are there any specific physical exam maneuvers or special tests that can help in the evaluation?
Yeah.
I recall seeing a mention of a couple of these.
Yes, there are a couple of well-known special tests that are frequently used during the physical examination to help assess for carpal tunnel syndrome.
Okay.
One is Phalen's test.
Okay.
This involves asking the patient to hold their wrists in a position of maximal flexion, bent all the way downwards for approximately 1 minute.
Okay.
If this posture provokes or worsens their symptoms of pain numbness or tingling in the fingers supplied by the median nerve, it's considered a positive test.
Okay, so why does holding the wrist in that flex position tend to trigger the symptoms in someone with carpal tunnel syndrome?
So in maximal wrist flexion, the space within the carpal tunnel is at its most constricted.
Right.
And any existing pressure on the median nerve is further increased.
Makes sense.
This can then reproduce or intensify the characteristic symptoms of the condition.
And the other common special test that's often performed?
The other frequently used test is Tinel's test.
Okay.
For this, the examiner gently taps over the course of the median nerve as it passes through the carpal tunnel and into the palm.
Okay.
A positive Tinel's test is indicated if this tapping elicits shock-like sensations that radiate into one or more of the radial digits.
Uh-huh.
Again, the thumb, index, and middle fingers, and the radial half of the ring finger.
Right.
This suggests irritation of the median nerve at the point where it's being compressed.
There's an important distinction made in the orthopedia chapter regarding these tests.
Yes.
Can you remind us of that?
Absolutely. Yeah. It's crucial to remember that the sensations that are elicited during both Phalen's and Tinel's tests are symptoms reported by the patient what they feel, and not objective signs that the examiner directly observes.
Right.
Therefore, the more accurate terminology is to refer to a positive Phalen's test or a positive Tinel's test, rather than using the terms Phalen's sign or Tinel's sign.
Okay.
It's a subtle but important distinction in clinical terminology.
Got it. So these physical exam tests provide suggestive evidence.
Yes.
And help guide the clinical suspicion.
Exactly.
What about more definitive diagnostic testing?
Uh-huh.
I know there are electrodiagnostic studies that can be performed.
Yes. Nerve conduction tests and electromyography, commonly referred to as EMG, are often used in the evaluation of patients who are suspected of having carpal tunnel syndrome.
Oh.
These two types of tests are frequently performed together to provide a more comprehensive picture.
Okay, and which of these two types of tests is considered the key to actually diagnosing carpal tunnel syndrome itself?
So while EMG can be valuable in ruling out other potential nerve or muscle problems that might mimic carpal tunnel syndrome, it's the nerve conduction test that is generally considered the primary diagnostic tool for confirming the presence and severity of carpal tunnel syndrome.
Okay, so how do these nerve conduction studies actually work?
Okay.
What specifically do they measure?
Nerve conduction studies work by measuring the speed and strength of electrical impulses as they travel along a nerve, in this case, the median nerve.
Okay.
Critically, in the context of carpal tunnel syndrome, these tests involve comparing the way the median nerve conducts these electrical signals as it passes across the carpal tunnel to two other measurements.
Okay.
The conduction velocity of the ulnar nerve in the hand.
Okay.
Which serves as a control or comparison.
Got it.
And also to the conduction velocity of the median nerve in segments of the arm that are proximal to the carpal tunnel, meaning closer to the elbow and shoulder.
Okay.
Think of it like measuring how fast a message travels down a wire. If the wire is pinched, the message slows down.
Right.
These tests compare the speed of the message in the median nerve at the wrist to other nearby nerves and to the same nerve further up the arm to see if there's a bottleneck in the carpal tunnel.
Okay, so what's the specific finding on these nerve conduction tests that indicates the presence of carpal tunnel syndrome?
The hallmark finding that is highly suggestive of carpal tunnel syndrome is a slowed conduction velocity.
Okay.
of the electrical impulse as it travels across the segment of the median nerve that passes through the carpal tunnel.
Right.
Especially when this is compared to the control measurements from the ulnar nerve and the more proximal segments of the median nerve.
Uh-huh.
This slowing indicates that the nerve is not transmitting signals as efficiently as it should through that compressed area within the tunnel.
Right.
This finding of a slowed conduction velocity across the carpal tunnel is considered to be both sensitive and specific for carpal tunnel syndrome.
So we've covered the anatomy function definition,
yes.
Clinical presentation. Potential causes, the important point about office work.
Yes.
Objective findings, special tests on physical exam.
Right.
Electrodiagnostic studies.
We've covered it all.
Now let's move on to what can be done to treat carpal tunnel syndrome.
Okay.
What are the initial non-operative treatment options that are typically recommended?
So treatment for carpal tunnel syndrome generally begins with non-operative approaches.
Okay.
The most common and frequently recommended conservative intervention is the consistent use of a wrist splint for immobilization.
So how does wearing a wrist splint help to alleviate the symptoms of carpal tunnel syndrome?
The wrist splint is typically worn at night and sometimes also during the day to keep the wrist in a neutral position.
Okay.
This neutral position helps to minimize the pressure within the carpal canal.
Uh-huh.
You could almost think of wearing a splint as performing a sort of reverse Phalen's maneuver.
Okay.
Keeping the wrist straight rather than flexed.
Right.
Thus providing more space for the median nerve.
Okay. Are there any other non-surgical treatments that are commonly used? I know the orthopedia chapter also mentions injections.
Another common non-operative treatment is a combined injection of a local anesthetic, such as lidocaine,
yeah.
and a corticosteroid into the carpal tunnel.
Right.
This injection serves a dual purpose.
Okay.
The corticosteroid is a potent anti-inflammatory medication that can help to reduce any swelling within the carpal tunnel, which in turn can alleviate some of the pressure on the median nerve.
Okay.
The local anesthetic can provide more immediate but temporary relief of symptoms.
Uh-huh.
Importantly, the degree and duration of symptom relief following the anesthetic injection can also provide some additional diagnostic information, helping to confirm if the carpal tunnel is indeed the source of the patient's symptoms.
So non-operative treatments are usually the first line of defense. But what happens when these measures don't provide sufficient relief, or if the nerve compression is more severe from the outset?
Right.
What are the operative or surgical treatment options for carpal tunnel syndrome?
In cases where non-operative treatments are not effective in providing adequate symptom relief, or if there is evidence of significant and progressive nerve compression, surgical decompression of the median nerve at the carpal tunnel may be considered.
Okay.
This surgical procedure involves releasing the transverse carpal ligament,
mm-hmm.
that fibrous roof of the carpal tunnel that we discussed earlier.
Right.
By dividing this ligament, the pressure on the median nerve within the tunnel is relieved.
So how is this surgical procedure typically performed?
Right.
Are there different techniques?
Yes, there are a few different surgical techniques that can be used to release the transverse carpal ligament.
Okay.
The traditional approach is open surgery, where a small incision is made in the palm of the hand to directly visualize the ligament and then carefully divide it.
Okay.
There are also minimally invasive techniques available,
uh-huh.
such as mini open surgery, which uses a smaller incision than traditional open surgery, and endoscopic techniques, which utilize a small camera and specialized surgical instruments that are inserted through even smaller incisions.
Wow.
Regardless of the specific surgical technique employed, a crucial consideration during the procedure is to carefully avoid any injury to the recurrent motor branch of the median nerve, which supplies some of the important muscles at the base of the thumb.
And what are the typical expected outcomes following carpal tunnel release surgery?
Surgical decompression of the median nerve generally provides reliable relief from the pain that is often associated with carpal tunnel syndrome.
Okay.
However, the recovery of sensory function, meaning the reduction or resolution of numbness and tingling, and the recovery of motor function, the return of strength and dexterity in the hand, can be more variable from person to person.
Why is the recovery of sensory and motor function less predictable than the relief of pain?
In general, if the median nerve has been subjected to chronic and severe compression over a long period of time and has experienced prolonged ischemia, that lack of adequate blood supply, the nerve fibers themselves may have sustained more significant damage. In these situations, the nerve is less likely to make a full recovery of its sensory and motor functions even after the pressure is surgically relieved.
Okay, so to really solidify our understanding of carpal tunnel syndrome, the orthopedia chapter highlights five key terms that are central to grasping this condition.
That's right.
So let's briefly review those now.
Okay.
The first term is compression neuropathy.
Yes.
What's the core meaning of that?
Compression neuropathy is precisely what the name suggests.
Okay.
It refers to a condition in which a peripheral nerve is subjected to pressure from surrounding tissues, leading to impaired function of that nerve.
Right.
In the context of carpal tunnel syndrome, this is the fundamental mechanism at play.
Uh-huh.
The median nerve is being compressed within the carpal tunnel by the surrounding structures.
Okay. The second key term is paresthesias.
Right.
We've discussed this in relation to symptoms.
Uh-huh.
What's the essential definition?
Paresthesias is the medical term that simply describes abnormal sensations, most commonly tingling, or that pins and needles feeling. It's a very characteristic symptom in compression neuropathies, like carpal tunnel syndrome, resulting from the irritated nerve fibers.
Next up is the median nerve itself.
Okay.
We've covered its functions in the hand, but what's the key definition to keep in mind for carpal tunnel syndrome?
The median nerve is a major peripheral nerve of the upper limb originating from the brachial plexus.
Uh-huh.
For our understanding of carpal tunnel syndrome, the most important aspects are its sensory innervation to the radial side of the hand, particularly the thumb, and its motor supply to specific muscles in the thumb that are crucial for fine motor control and grasping.
Okay, the fourth key term is the transverse carpal ligament.
Yes.
Why is this specific anatomical structure so critical in the context of carpal tunnel syndrome?
So the transverse carpal ligament forms the roof of the carpal tunnel.
Okay.
Unlike the floor and sides of the tunnel, which are made of bone, this roof is composed of ligamentous tissue. Critically, it's this ligament that can be surgically released in order to decompress the median nerve and alleviate the symptoms associated with carpal tunnel syndrome.
And finally, the fifth key term is nerve conduction test.
Okay.
What should we remember about this diagnostic procedure in relation to carpal tunnel syndrome?
Nerve conduction tests are the primary electrodiagnostic studies used to evaluate and diagnose carpal tunnel syndrome.
Right.
The key thing to remember is that these tests measure the speed at which electrical signals travel along the median nerve.
Mm-hmm.
And they can help to identify areas where the conduction of these signals is slowed down or blocked, specifically as the nerve passes through the carpal tunnel at the wrist.
Yeah.
This slowing of the conduction velocity across the carpal tunnel is an objective finding that strongly supports the diagnosis of carpal tunnel syndrome.
Well, we've been exploring the carpal tunnel syndrome chapter from Orthopedia.
We have.
The world's best free and peer-reviewed textbook of musculoskeletal medicine.
It is.
Orthopedia.
Yes.
By Bernstein, Pinney, and Vayet. It is available at www.orthopedia.com at no charge.
At no charge.
And again, before you take a test, and certainly before you take care of a patient, don't rely on us.
Read the book.
Read the book.
You'll be glad you did.
So what's really striking when you delve into carpal tunnel syndrome is how a seemingly small and localized anatomical structure, like the carpal tunnel, can be the source of such a specific and often debilitating set of symptoms in the hand.
Yeah, it really highlights the intricate and delicate relationship between the physical structures of our bodies,
right,
and the complex workings of our nervous system.
Yeah.
It also prompts you to think about the challenges in definitively pinpointing a single cause for many medical conditions, even when we have a good understanding of the underlying mechanisms,
right,
as we see with the idiopathic nature of the majority of carpal tunnel syndrome cases.
That's a fascinating point to consider.